The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There was an internal process inside the administration about whether or not the administration and the White House would go to Congress and ask for new laws to deal with the new encryption capabilities. The administration decided not to. Then we have San Bernardino. Now we have an investigation, which is an important investigation, but we don't have simply one little, you know, part of the investigation. We all of a sudden have an enormous public controversy created by the FBI. So I think that the question of whether or not there's anything really useful or necessary on that phone does go to what is the FBI trying to do here.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 4th, 2016. Apple, FBI, the Wilson Center in Washington took on the controversy this week in a panel entitled Will They or Won't They? Understanding the Encryption Debate. Congressman Ted Lieu of California discusses the encryption challenge with Lawfare's own Susan Hennessy and Kate Martin of the Center for American Progress. Politico's Dave Perara moderates the discussion as a tale of three iPhones. The first is the iPhone at issue in a New York drug prosecution. The second iPhone is the one at the center of the California controversy regarding the provision of assistance to the FBI in the San Bernardino case. And then there's iPhone number three, the iPhone of the future, a theoretical phone with security features so robust there is no conceivable way to provide any kind of assistance or law enforcement access whatsoever. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 160, Apple v. FBI at the Wilson Center.
Good afternoon, everyone who's physically here or watching. I'm Jane Harmon, the president and CEO of the Wilson Center, a recovering politician. My role in Congress for most of my nine terms overlapped the subject that we are dealing with today, and it is my great pleasure to welcome good friends on this panel, but first a shout out to my congressman and good friend Ted Lieu for joining us. Ted literally is my congressman. I am still a resident of Venice Beach, California, which I represented all those years, and Ted represents Venice Beach, California and other parts, and again, Ted, 20 years later, thanks for looking out for what was then my young son, Dan, while you were a member of, the State Assembly, or maybe the Torrance City Council. We go way back. Encryption is timely. It's important. And Ted is one of the only members who actually understands the bits and the bytes, thanks to a bachelor's degree in computer science from Stanford. No one here has missed the showdown between Apple and the FBI. Jim Comey says he needs Apple's help breaking into the San Bernardino gunman's phone. Apple says that complying would endanger its products and American data everywhere. We should all care how this ends. We're in uncharted territory. The FBI wants Tim Cook's engineers to build a brand new custom operating system. Critics call it GovOS or FBIOS. That's easier for the Bureau to an operating system that would be easier for the Bureau to open and search. Some call it a golden key or a back door. Director Comey says it's a front door, a lawful search for leads from a dead homegrown terrorist. Either way, it's a battle over much more than one phone. Manhattan's District Attorney Cy Vance says he has 175 Apple devices sitting in New York evidence lockers that he can't unlock. The Los Angeles PD has several hundred more, and Apple has already flagged more than a dozen cases across the United States where the FBI wants it to crack down, to crack its own security systems. If Apple unlocks one device, where will the line be drawn? The end game, whatever it is, will impact your phone, my phone, and millions of others. It could have huge consequences for American tech firms, American cops and spies, and every American and probably every world citizen's cybersecurity. As I mentioned, this is an area I know something about. I was a senior member of the House Intelligence Committee on 9/11. I was briefed as part of the so-called Gang of Eight on what was then called Stellar Wind, which was the precursor to the bulk telephone metadata program. I insisted then and believe now that security and liberty are not a zero-sum game. You get more of both or you get neither. Two former congressional colleagues of mine, Ted's colleagues, Zoe Lofgren, a Democrat from California, and Daryl Issa, a Republican, wrote an op-ed yesterday for the Los Angeles Times, my hometown paper. They say the debate is too big for one courtroom. The conversation belongs to Congress. And so here at the Wilson Center today, we want to kickstart that dialogue. We have a rock star program starting with Congressman Ted Lieu, a leader on these issues and one of Congress's few genuine techies. We're also pleased to welcome another good friend, Kate Martin, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the former longtime director of the Center for National Security Studies, and someone I consulted regularly trying to wrap my old brain around these very tough issues. We also have Susan Hennessy. Is she here? Yes, there she is. I can't see her. Managing editor of Lawfare and former NSA National Security Agency lawyer, and Dave Pereira, cybersecurity reporter for Politico Pro, who will expertly moderate the panel and introduce Congressman Lieu, who will make opening remarks. So one more shout out, and that is to Meg King in the blue sweater, who would be hiding in the back if she could. But Meg directs our Digital Futures program. I think everyone would agree that she has brought incredible tech expertise to the Wilson Center. I don't actually know how she learned all this stuff, since I remember her as a staffer on Team Harmon on Capitol Hill, and I don't think she knew anything like this. But again, the world wasn't like this, and that's the point. The world is evolving minute by minute. We're going to stay on top or ahead of this at the Wilson Center, and it is really good news that a few people in Congress are paying attention. So now please welcome our panel and our moderator.
Thank you so much for coming. We've already done introductions. Ted has a few things to say at the top, and then we'll dive into the conversation. And just so you know, we will be taking questions from the audience after I've had a chance to exercise my ego a little bit and ask the panel some questions. So,
sure. Thank you. It's such an honor to be here. And let me thank Jane Harmon and the Wilson Center for hosting this event. And it was really an honor for me to grow up watching Jane Harmon. I learned so much from her. I saw how she worked on a bipartisan basis to get things done in Congress. And I saw her amazing leadership on national security. And back then, as I say now, I went to sleep at night perfectly fine because she was my congresswoman. So thank you, Jane, for all that you did for our country. Really appreciate it. And I'm really honored to be here with this terrific panel. And as Congresswoman Harmon said, I am a recovering computer science major, so I know a little bit about CS issues. But I also served active duty in the Air Force. I'm still in the reserves. And when it comes to terrorists, I believe we should hunt them down and kill them. Government's first priority is public safety, and that's why I support Apple's position, because strong encryption is a U.S. national security priority. And I'm going to make just three brief points. I believe the FBI intentionally is trying to frame this issue as one of privacy versus national security. That is the wrong frame. The actual frame should be making some law enforcement investigations easier versus national security. And if you look at our national security leaders, none of them are saying, yes, let's weaken encryption. Let's put in backdoors. In fact, they're saying the opposite, and it's quite extraordinary. You now have the Secretary of Defense saying that strong encryption is a U.S. priority. He's against backdoors, and he also says we shouldn't do things based on moments of anger and grief. He is directly undercutting the FBI's message. You also have Michael Hayden, former director of NSA, saying, basically, I support Apple's position. Strong encryption is a U.S. national security priority. So that should be the right frame. Do we want to make law enforcement's jobs somewhat easier, but then weaken our national security? That's the debate. Second point is, you layer on top of that all these enormously important issues, such as privacy, such as the relationship between our government and you, right? How much do you want our government to be able to compel you to take extraordinary actions to assist law enforcement? Let's say the Apple team that developed their smartphone left, went to Google. Could the FBI then compel Google to do extraordinary actions to help break into an Apple iPhone? At what limit do we have? At what end do we want? Do we want our government to be able to compel people to take these actions to help law enforcement? And then on top of that, we have effects on U.S. businesses abroad, and this is not going to affect smartphones here and businesses here, but countries around the world. And then the final point is, because of how important these issues are, we really shouldn't let precedent be set and these issues be decided by unelected judges interpreting an 18th century statute. And that's what the Department of Justice and the FBI are trying to do. They're trying to use the All Writs Act, something passed in 1789, nearly 90 years before Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. And they're trying to use that to set precedent in this case. I believe that's wrong. It should be something that Congress decides. So once again, it's an honor to be here and look forward to answering questions and listening to my panel members.
Thank you so much. So that sets the stage a fair amount. In order to tackle this issue, it's pretty complex. There's a lot of moving parts. We decided we're going to divvy it up into a tale of three iPhones. So we have the first iPhone that set this off, at least in the context of Apple, and the government trying to get special access to an Apple device. And that is an iPhone that's at the center of a, or at the periphery, rather, of a methamphetamine distribution case in New York City. Susan, can you just quickly tell us what's going on there?
Right, so this is the case. We good? So this is the case that you might have heard of over the past couple of days of a New York judge says FBI can't force Apple to unlock an iPhone. You might be sort of confused that there are multiple cases going on. This is a case in New York in the Eastern District. New York in the Eastern District. What's really important to understand about that case is it's an iOS 7. And the difference between an iOS 7 there's a number of detailed technical differences in terms of how the device is created. The important thing to understand is that Apple has the capacity to not unlock the phone, but actually to bypass the lock mechanism to extract the data. They maintain that capability voluntarily. They provided the service to the FBI approximately 70 times in the past, pursuant to an All Writs Act order. And they've declined to do so in this case. And so they're challenging the use of the All Writs Act to compel the kind of assistance at question. So it's important to sort of understand where we are, sort of the questions about compelling them to write new codes. Those arise in California some months later. So a magistrate judge in New York has said that this is an improper application of the All Writs Act. The Department of Justice has already appealed that decision, and it'll certainly go up to the district court, if not the circuit court level, within the next couple weeks.
Kate. Should Apple, it's done it 70 times before at the very least, unlock that iPhone? It doesn't require it to code a custom operating system, which is what the FBI is asking for in the case of the San Bernardino shooters, county issued, it wasn't his own iPhone, county issued iPhone. Should they do it in Brooklyn?
So rather than directly answer your difficult question, I'm going to lay out what I think the issues are. I think, first of all, it's really important to note that this case and the San Bernardino case are cases where the government, law enforcement, has a warrant to get the information that it's seeking on the phone. And when you step back and we talk more broadly about the encryption debate, one of the things I think we have to keep in mind is that when law enforcement says, oh, well, we only want to get access to information for which we have a warrant, that in fact, that's not completely true. That there are many instances in which they want access to information in which they don't have a warrant. And so that's an important backdrop. So here they have a warrant, which means that there is no fundamental Fourth Amendment problem in getting access to the information on the phone. And the case really does revolve around the application of this statute, the All Writs Act. What is the way the All Writs Act comes up is in wiretapping cases more generally, the Congress has already required the telephone companies, for example, to provide technical assistance to law enforcement when they want to conduct a lawful wiretap with a warrant.
Through CALEA?
No, there are actually sometimes through CALEA, but CALEA does something slightly different. The Wiretap Act itself, there are several provisions of the Wiretap Act, directly require the telephone companies to give assistance in carrying out wiretaps. Then we have CALEA, which was a statute that said they have to build the telephone systems in a way that they will be wiretap accessible, but we leave the details of that up to the telephone companies. None of those statutes which specifically require companies to help the government in carrying out warrants apply to Apple in this situation or to the iPhone. And so the government is relying on the All Writs Act as a, quote, gap filler statute to say you have an obligation to help law enforcement facilitate this lawful search.
Can you voice an opinion? Is Apple doing the correct thing by resisting the FBI request, specifically in Brooklyn, which is, as Susan has noted, is different than the one in San Bernardino?
So I think Apple is correct in requiring a court to rule on these legal issues rather than simply turning over information in response to a court order. I think it's more... I'm now going to state an unpopular opinion. I think it's more questionable whether or not it's such a slam dunk one way or the other. I think in some ways, I'm not sure that I agree that we want Congress to take this particular issue up right away. One of the things that's the court can do, which the Congress is not so great at, is look at the specific operating system, the specific ways in which Apple would have to take steps to unlock that operating system, the specific reasons why the government needs the information and what the warrant is for the information. And the All Writs Act, in some ways, says to the court, look at all those factors, balance them, and come to a conclusion about whether or not the court is going to compel Apple to give assistance in this particular case. So I'm not going to express a view about that particular case. I do think that there might be some utility in, for those of us who care about privacy, to recognize that the All Writs Act could have a useful role to play because it requires the involvement of a judge and it requires a particular showing by the government before it can invoke that assistance.
Ted?
I actually don't disagree with you that Congress shouldn't take this up right away, which is why I'm a co-author of legislation that Chairman McCaul and Senator Warner introduced, which puts together an expert panel of very, very smart people. They're going to look at this issue, provide recommendations to Congress. And so something Congress can do that courts can't is we can look at much broader issues, how does it affect society as a whole, and have lots of hearings, have lots of very intelligent experts, have people from the Wilson Center weigh in, and we can then craft policy. So I do believe we do need to take time on this. This is very complicated. But on the Neura case, I'll give you my answer. I support Apple's position, as does the judge in this case, Judge Ornstein, who wrote an opinion that I thought was a pretty good opinion. And he writes in there that he doesn't believe that the folks that passed the All Writs Act in 1789 intended to solve that debate then ended there. We're in a whole new world in the 21st century, and applying 18th century statute to a 21st century problem, I don't think it's going to give us very much confidence in the results. And I also just note that, you know, the FBI director wrote an open letter recently, right? How many times has the FBI director ever done that? He could have done that on this case, which is much earlier than the San Bernardino case. But they realized, right, having, you know, making prosecution of drug dealer versus privacy, that was not a very good frame for them. So I do think that there is some intentionality behind the FBI picking this specific case, and to me, that does seem inappropriate.
So I will give you an answer. I do think Apple, so I think the first thing to note is there's nothing unpatriotic about Apple challenging a court order. That's the right of an American company, and if a company believes there is defective process, it's their right and their obligation to ensure that a federal judge take up the issue and tell them yes or no. So sort of with that at the outset. That said, you know, Judge Ornstein's opinion, you know, which will certainly go up on appeal and we'll sort of, we'll get the ultimate answer on that. Regarding the applicability of the All Writs Act, look, yes, the All Writs Act is a 1789 statute. The Bill of Rights was ratified in 1791, a mere 2 years later. We still think that that's pretty good law. So the notion that laws sort of die of old age just doesn't hold, right? Like that's sort of, that's not, I think another way to refer to those laws would be bedrock principles, sort of, right? Foundational to United States jurisprudence. So I think it's important to understand there are a lot of ways to look at these things. The important thing about the Apple case is that there are no security concerns there, right? Apple has the software in question. They voluntarily engineered it. They protect it. There's been no intimation that they've ever been compromised in that case. There's a warrant. Now, I think it's important to sort of understand what is happening in terms of the argument, in terms of whether or not it's Congress has a role to speak here. Because essentially what Apple is asserting in the Eastern District of New York is not its security concerns. It's actually asserting a question of reputational harm. There are rules under court precedent, 1977 Supreme Court case, that says a court can compel this type of third-party assistance under a number of limited sort of conditions. Can't be an undue burden. You have to be closely related. There has to be necessity, sort of, you have to consider all these prongs. Again, it's for a federal judge to decide if the facts in a particular case, and I think it's appropriate for a federal judge to make those determinations, and they're better situated often. That said, you know, what Apple is really asserting in the Eastern District is that All Writs is not an appropriate application because All Writs is supposed to be this gap-filling statute. Really, this is a matter for Congress to decide. Congress should be speaking here. We're now stretching the scope of All Writs beyond sort of what feels comfortable to us. That might not be wrong, right? So it's possible that a judge might say, well, you know, that might be true, but this is an appropriate application. But actually, Apple itself is starting to assert these sort of concerns about Congress needing to speak in this area, actually as a defense to being compelled to do something. So I think whenever sort of all sides are saying it's time for Congress to speak, you know, it's important to recognize the way that the role of Congress is really being raised in the court process now, that it's getting harder and harder to sort of separate the two out.
Judge Ornstein, the judge in the Eastern District of New York, otherwise known as Brooklyn, suggested in his ruling that Congress has spoken. Congress spoke through two ways. Through CALEA, it ruled out the kind of technical thing that the government is asking Apple to do. It considered it, and it rejected it explicitly in through CALEA, because CLIA says that you do not have to decrypt communications on the government's demand. It also classifies Apple as an information service, and it says specifically that or Apple is an information service, and information services are excluded from the scope of CLIA. There's a number of reasons why CLIA does not apply. Judge Orenstein also said, and this is maybe the weaker of his arguments, that Congress has already spoken when it debated and rejected expansion of CLIA.
Right. So sort of to sort of put Orenstein's decision in its appropriate context, this is sort of the next decision in what sort of has been colloquially termed the revolt of the magistrates. It's very unusual for a magistrate judge to issue an opinion at all. Orenstein has issued a 50-page opinion in this case. And so ultimately, a district judge will decide whether or not these somewhat novel legal arguments are valid. The more traditional understanding of CLIA, again, a federal judge might eventually decide otherwise, and Orenstein has decided otherwise, is that CLIA applies to data in transit. It's a wire, it's an interception statute, and what's at issue here is not implicated. Sort of the larger issue of what Congress says when Congress says nothing is a difficult one to reconcile. So even within Orenstein's opinion, he cites to the sort of the case precedent, which says that when Congress doesn't say anything, you can draw two equally tenable explanations for that, right? Either Congress affirmatively endorses the status quo, or Congress really wants to change things in an aggressive way and doesn't see...
Ted, say nothing if you agree with Susan.
I'll keep going.
Just the notion that there that you can't sort of draw a conclusion whenever Congress has not spoken. And so that's sort of just teasing out that those are sort of the two separate arguments that he's asserting there.
I think it's important to sort of understand the context in which this is happening. I believe Congress did speak, right? The FBI tried to get this proposal through last year, and they couldn't get a single member of Congress to carry a bill that would do that. So my view is Congress spoke by not accepting what the FBI and DOJ wanted to have happen. But there's another element here to consider, which is courts interpret laws. Courts don't have an independent authority to make people do stuff, right? They can't compel you to take actions. They need a source of authority, which is a law. And in this case, they're citing, right, this All Writs Act, and what the judge is saying is, I don't think that law was meant to apply in this situation. So if Congress is just silent, the courts can't come up with its own authority to make you do something. They actually need some sort of a statutory basis to compel action. And so if Congress is silent, I think that silence does actually speak volumes.
So let's move on to the second iPhone in our tale of three iPhones, and that is the one in San Bernardino. Kate, do you want to do the pressy?
Sure. Probably most of you know, so I'll try to be short but specific. The FBI has the iPhone that was used by one of the dead terrorists in San Bernardino. That iPhone belonged to his employer. So it has a warrant to access the information on that iPhone, but it can't do so because the information on the iPhone is protected by a passcode. And it has taken steps and to get whatever information that was on the iPhone and was also in the iCloud, they've gotten. So this is information that doesn't exist anyplace else, if it exists at all, but potentially on the iPhone of the dead killer. In order for that information to be accessed, what the FBI has proposed to the court and is the following, that there are three mechanisms that Apple has put in the operating system of that phone so that someone can't use what's called brute force, which is running every conceivable combination to find the passcode to break into the phone. And those features are that they're quite clever, actually, I think. One is that if someone makes 10 wrong tries, the phone just blows itself up. No, it erases all the information on the phone. The second one is that if you want to try multiple times to get into the phone, you have to wait between each time. So the FBI says that if that feature wasn't disabled, it would take them 26 years to try all of the different possible passcodes. But if the third feature was disabled, which requires the passcode to be typed in, you know, manually by some finger, and instead the phone was configured so that the FBI could use an automated way of typing in the passcodes, the FBI would be able, using brute force, to get access to the information on the phone in 26 minutes. So what the FBI has done is asked the court to use the All Writs Act to order Apple to write the software that would disable those three particular features on this particular phone. And there's a lot of back and forth about how that would be done. Would they give the phone to Apple? Would, which we can talk about, which kind of goes to some of Apple's objections to being ordered to do that.
So, Susan, in this case, Apple's being asked not to just break into one of its products, but to actually affirmatively do something no tech company has ever done, and that is write custom software for the federal government that breaks its own product. All Writs Act really applies here?
Right, so we're now getting into kind of the hard territory, at least to my mind. This would be a novel application of the All Writs. They're being compelled to create something. I do think it's important to sort of understand the choice that's being made here and why. So the government is not saying that they don't have the capacity to write the code. It might be harder for them. They might, have some unintended consequences. Certainly Apple's going to be better. The problem is that the way Apple has created their devices, that they only run software that has been signed by Apple's basically special signing key. And there's been sort of in this larger debate about encryption, a lot of discussions about notions of key escrow, and the tech community has really asserted very strongly, and I think really rather reasonably, that these are the keys to their kingdom. The U.S. government cannot be trusted to keep this stuff safe.
And by key escrow, just to jump in, you're talking about the concept whereby companies would store their keys with a third party, retrievable by the government in circumstances such as this.
Right, exactly. That a company would be required to put its signing key somewhere else. And so essentially what's happened here is that the government has said, okay, we believe you. We don't trust ourselves with this key. We buy that we should not be messing with sort of encryption in the genuine sense of the word. We also believe that this is really important equity to protect. The problem is that if you don't give us the key, you have to write the software because we can't sign the software in question. And so I think that in sort of that context, certainly a judge is going to have to decide, right, is this an appropriate application of the law, it's important to understand what the trade-offs, why the government thinks that it might be reasonable to ask this kind of heightened assistance, because of course, as with all laws, as technologies change, the laws, like we reinterpret the laws and we see whether or not they can be stretched. I think that this is starting to raise questions of, was this the intention of sort of the All Writs gap filling, right? Is there really a gap here? We're starting to get into the realm of really substantive law where we would expect to see statutes on the matter. There are certainly difficult legal questions in California. That said, no matter what happens in California, we're all collectively going to have to decide what we want the future to look like. And to my mind, what's really at stake in California is whether or not we want the scope of government access, of lawful government access, to be dictated by our laws, by the Fourth Amendment, by courts, by warrants, by a neutral magistrate, or if we want the scope of that access to be dictated by technology. reasonable minds can differ, and there are all sorts of really complex equities on either side. But really, whenever you get down to the core values choice here, I think that's whenever you're seeing two sides that are really having difficulty sort of reconciling what are very deeply held notions.
Ted, are there constitutional issues at play here?
Absolutely. I think it is unprecedented for a court to compel a private sector company to take extraordinary actions, which is to create software they do not have to weaken their own product. And that is simply a legal issue that
But not just under the All Writs Act. Are there Fifth Amendment or First Amendment?
Right. So Apple raises First and Fifth Amendment issues. They do say writing computer code is equivalent to freedom of speech and that they shouldn't be compelled to do this speech. Not sure what I think of that. I think their stronger argument is that All Writs Act does not apply in this case, particularly when the government, FBI, tried to get this authority through Congress and Congress rejected it. I think it's helpful to take a step back and think about not just Apple, right? It's not just about this company. If this happened to have been a Microsoft product, same thing would have happened. Microsoft is about to write a legal brief in support of Apple. You also have the American Library Association coming in support of Apple. Right? Why are they involved? Well, they're involved because they don't see any limits to this. If the court interprets the All Writs Act to be able to compel this kind of action, what's to keep a court from telling Amazon, hey, you create software to identify for us people we think are suspicious based on the books that they order, and you send that to the FBI. You can imagine all sorts of actions the government can compel you to do to assist law enforcement. And my view is that private individuals and private sector companies are not an arm of law enforcement. And I think this case raises very troubling issues about the relationship of our government to you.
So I would just add that Susan and Congressman raised the kind of larger policy questions, is that I think there's a risk here in connection with the approach that Apple is taking, which is that if you step back for a moment and ask the question, well, who's going to decide or who's going to have access to information that's been encrypted? And when is the government, if ever, going to have access to information that's been encrypted? And how are we going to decide that? So that's a very large question that has many subparts, depending on what kind of devices you're talking about, what kind of information you're talking about, which part of the government, what kind of process, are they going to have a warrant, or are they going to have something else? If you step back and go, well, this particular case where the government has a warrant, there is no privacy interest at stake in connection with the data on the phone. Do we have a real problem in compelling a company to help decrypt this information on this phone in these circumstances? So the problem, as I see it, is that whether or not Congress has in fact already given the judge the power to order that kind of compulsion, as you said, Congressman, in the All Writs Act. But if you step back and say, well, as a society, do we want a judge to have that kind of power? I think the answer might well be yes in this particular situation. And what I am very concerned about is that Apple and some of the other industries' position is, okay, so we're going to fight this in court. If they lose in court, it will give the FBI much greater ability to come to Congress to ask for the kind of law that the All Writs Act is not. But that in asking for those changes in the law, law enforcement and the intelligence community are likely to ask for much broader powers and are likely to ask for the power to access information when they don't have a warrant, but they just have a national security letter, or they just have a FISA 702 order, or many of the other kinds of authorities that gives the government access. And that's the danger that we run when, with all due respect, at the moment, doesn't seem to me that we have the political context in which we will end up with the wisest decision-making process. Okay, shall I just say it? On this kind of problem.
Right. Well, you got it. Just to push back on that a little bit, I think that one way to sort of describe it is to say you don't think you'll get the law that you think is ideal. Traditionally, we understand that we express those values by voting for elected representatives. I think it's important to note here that Congress is not obligated to pass a law that says Apple and all companies shall compel. They're actually equally empowered to pass a law that says no company shall have to compel. They could repeal CALEA, right? The sort of the scope of what Congress is empowered to do on our behalfs is essentially limitless, right? It's sort of only the Constitution is the limiting factor there. And so I think it's important to sort of to realize whenever we see these polls that say, you know, 49% or 51%, and sort of who cares which side is which, right? It's sort of it's a roughly divided country on these issues at this point. You know, the way we traditionally resolve these kinds of really difficult values decisions is we elect members to Congress and they vote, and they vote on behalf of their constituents in a way that they think are a noble discharge of that service. And so I'm always a little bit suspicious at the notion of, well, you know, we want a law and we don't want to use the gap filling, but it's because we're afraid that they're going to pass a bad law. Right, as I agree that there should be a careful consideration here that the going in principle should be first do no harm. That said, I think that I'm always suspicious of sort of stall tactics, honestly, because I think sort of the fundamental democratic process here is we have opinions and you guys vote.
So I've got a really cool law to tell you about. I learned from Representative Jane Harman to work on a bipartisan basis. So a couple weeks ago, I introduced the Encrypt Act with Republican Blake Fahrenthold, Republican Mike Bishop, and Democrat Suzanne Delveen. And what this law does is it says states cannot mandate encryption backdoors in consumer products, because you had California in New York with state legislators introducing bills that were going to require companies like Google and Apple and so on to put backdoors into their products. And that made no sense, right? Because you can't have, you know, Google make a smartphone just for California and not for Kansas. So that's going to work its way through. So I think that's a good law. Now, so your notion, there is a risk that we could get a crazy liar for president, right? There's all sorts of risk. But I think it's important to note that in this specific San Bernardino case, when you talk about Apple fighting in court, they didn't pick this fight. If you read what happened, according to Apple, they read about the court filing in the newspapers. They were working with the FBI. They provided a huge amount of assistance. They provided their engineers. They provided all sorts of advice. And I think the FBI saw an opportunity to try to frame this issue in a very particular way, to try to get the American public on their side. And again, when's the last time you saw the FBI director write an open letter? It wasn't addressed to the judge, because they were just concerned about this case, this phone. He would not have done that. But he wrote an open letter to influence the American public, which is fine. It's where the debate should be. It's where it should happen.
Just to correct, because he did publish that letter
on our
Lawfare book. He actually did write a piece back in July, sort of putting out the encryption challenge, talking about what law enforcement equities are like, asking for ideas and support, for partnership, for engagement. And so I think, one, he actually has written sort of specifically the open letter in the past. And, you know, I do think that law enforcement has at least attempted to be sort of open with their equities here.
I want to ask a question about the All Writs Act, just to take us back there a little bit, because it's the law that's sort of at the crux of all this. And the Supreme Court, as I understood it, established, as you said, Susan, there's three basic tests. There's proximity to the issue at hand. There is, would it be an undue burden? And is there any necessity? Let's talk about necessity. Does that iPhone, anybody actually think, have any evidence on it that the FBI truly has a compelling, urgent need to do to get at, especially given the wealth of metadata that the FBI already has been able to extract? It knows who he's called, who Syed Farooq has called. It knows the content of his SMS messages. It knows what apps he's downloaded. It even has a backup copy of the iPhone, albeit one dated back to October 19th. But, I mean, we're not talking about a huge gap. Isn't it really just a opportunity for the FBI to make a point rather than to actually gather evidence?
So, look, I have sort of two reactions because this has been raised quite a bit. One is that we don't want certain laws for when law enforcement, like, really, really, really wants evidence, and whenever they just, like, they kind of want evidence, right? The rule is supposed to be set with whether or not a judge says they can get it, and then that's the rule. So a little bit, I think, while certainly, you know, the facts might be more friendly in one case or another, sort of it might be more or less useful in terms of the public conversation. I think it's important to understand we're attempting to develop kind of neutral principles here.
Well, sure, but the All Writs Act says necessity.
Mm. Right, so necessity goes to whether or not the government can do it itself, right? So it's that the assistance in question is necessary. Kind of the necessity you're talking about is whether or not law enforcement needs access. That certainly goes to, you know, kind of how we all balance, right? So it's totally reasonable that the American people decide, you know, this technology is really important to our lives. The cybersecurity threat is massive, you know, and we think that we are willing to accept the FBI not having access to some amount of information. You know, my personal sense, and I'll sort of put on my former IC hat for this, you know, this is sort of a weird terrorist event, for lack of a better word, right? It's kind of a workplace shooting. It's kind of a terrorist event. It's really important that the FBI understand what happened, why it happened. You know, there was allegedly sort of a fight at a party. You know, were they planning this terrorist event, you know, for long periods of time? You know, was this always the intended target? You know, these are important things to which the phone would certainly have at least some value. And so I think the sort of the right question to be asking is not, you know, do they expect to find, you know, the sleeper cell on his work phone? No, probably not. But this is a meaningful investigative lead. It's as important a lead kind of as any, at least conceptually. This is the kinds of investigative work we would expect law enforcement, right? We expect them to be investigating these crimes. That includes looking at the phone. And so I'm not sure, I'm always sort of suspicious of this question of how valuable is it, right? The question is, if it's of any value, then the larger discussion just becomes one of whether or not the law applies or not.
Kate, you look like you have something to say.
Well, I'm more skeptical of what the FBI was doing. If you go back a couple of months, there was an internal process inside the administration about whether or not the administration and the White House would go to Congress and ask for new laws to deal with the new encryption capabilities. And the administration decided not to. And I think we have to remember why, and one of the reasons is because as the Secretary of Defense and everyone up and below him, to the President, et cetera, has acknowledged, strong encryption is essential to maintain the security or to create more security in the internet. And the internet is an essential component of our security, and it's made insecure, and the companies who are working on encryption are making it more secure. So they decided not to go to Congress, that the trade-off did not require a new law. Then we have San Bernardino. Now we have an investigation, which is an important investigation, but we don't have simply one little, you know, part of the investigation. We all of a sudden have an enormous public controversy created by the FBI on, you can't really believe that encryption should prevent us from getting access to the phone of this dead terrorist. So I think that the question of whether or not there's anything really useful or necessary on that phone does go to what is the FBI trying to do here? And, you know, it's quite legitimate for them to try to influence the public debate on encryption. But let's be clear that that's what they're doing more than trying to get the information on that this particular phone.
So I agree that the San Bernardino case has a sort of a particular emotional resonance. That's actually not the case that Jim Comey has been sort of yelling about on the Hill. He testified just 2 or 3 weeks ago at this point. And yes, he mentioned the San Bernardino case, but he actually mentioned another case, an iOS 9, a woman 8 months pregnant. She opens her door and she's murdered. No leads in that case, no idea who did it. The family, you know, has given consent to open the phone. She has a detailed diary on the phone. The FBI is certain that there is some evidence about what she planned to do that day in that phone, and they can't unlock it. I don't think that this is a case of the FBI sort of just, you know, trying to use kind of the most dramatic set of facts. You know, whenever I sort of personally think about, well, how do I come down on these issues and where do my
That's
values
the second
lie?
Most dramatic set of facts. The dead woman. Right.
Right. But these are all real things, and I think it's reasonable to decide another value is more important, but it's not reasonable to pretend as though people don't really care about investigating terrorist attacks. It's not reasonable to pretend like people aren't really murdered in this country. The biggest issue with encrypted data at rest encryption is child pornography. Now, a lot of people sort of say that's fear-mongering. That's reality. Now, we might decide that as a nation, our online security values, where we think the future is going, the way we want our relationship to our government to look like, that all means that we don't expect companies to provide this kind of assistance. But we have to do that eyes open and understanding what the trade-offs could potentially be.
Let's talk about the third iPhone. This is a hypothetical iPhone. This is an iPhone that Apple could make that would actually make this argument about San Bernardino moot. It could put security features in a next generation of iPhone that would make it impossible for anybody to get in. There are some technical details about how it would do so. It would make the secure enclave. It would make one of the chips on the inside of the iPhone much more harder to update. We don't have to get into the technical details. Is there anybody going to say that Apple shouldn't do that? That there actually should be a law preventing Apple from making the iPhone so secure that not even it can get into it?
If they did that, maybe we should ask Apple to protect our national security secrets, right? I mean, I was in oversight committee last year having hearing after hearing of massive breaches in our federal government. For example,
we'll have a warehouse of iPhones and we'll still.
The security clearance hack of 27 million records affecting me personally, right? A foreign government now has my most sensitive information as well as my spouse's. It was because of a lack of encryption, other strong cybersecurity defenses. So we need to upgrade encryption and cybersecurity in both the private and public sector. And keep in mind that virtually every federal employee has a smartphone of some sort, whether it's government issued or your personal one. And they keep huge amounts of information on that phone. And do you really want to make it easier for foreign adversaries to hack those phones? You don't. And that's why our national security establishment has largely come out saying strong encryption is a U.S. national security priority. We don't want to weaken that. We don't want to create vulnerabilities. And I would be completely fine with the future iPhone that you described.
So I might actually surprise you on this. I'm sure there are some people that will say, no, Apple shouldn't be able to create that phone. No, I actually think Apple should be able to create that phone. I think it would be a real mistake to try and dictate laws telling companies how to build their products. I think Apple has an obligation to make the safest, most secure phones they possibly can, you know, weighing all of their various business equities sort of along, you know, along the way. I think that, you know, with all due, you know, even though the congressman is one of, I think, four people who have a computer science degree. Sometimes whenever Congress wades into technical issues, some of your colleagues have less of a gentle touch. And so I actually think that that kind of law probably ends up doing more harm than good. what I would think would be useful in clarifying law, and useful in clarifying sort of no matter where it comes down, is a law that explains to companies exactly what the scope of their obligation looks like. Coming from my background, I'm very skeptical of the notion that there's such a thing as a phone you can't get into. And so I think that while certainly, you know, we're all going to have to accept the fact that there's certain information law enforcement isn't going to be able to see in the future. Now, there are other places where there might be methods to fill in those gaps. Those are going to create a whole other set of problems, right? Who can spy on you through your refrigerator and waffle maker and all these things. They're already thinking about this. Right, and so... the vulnerabilities are going to continue to exist. And so really, what's at issue in New York, what's at issue in California, is not an issue of encryption. It's an issue of lawful hacking, of device hacking. And this is where sort of it can be difficult to frame. While I 100% agree with every statement both of you have made on encryption, I also think that it would be a terrible mistake to sort of put in genuine backdoors or force people to alter cryptologic standards. That all seems really problematic to me. The sort of limited scope, the limited ability to access device hacking, requesting that companies pursuant to the law provide some level of assistance, and I think that level of assistance should probably be dictated by Congress and not all writs, whether or not the law might apply. I think sort of ultimately, whenever we get there, that's probably the right solution. I think that there is a way to sort of find our way through this. I don't think it has to be kind of, it's 2016 and we're going to decide what the future looks like and off we go. I think we can take one step at a time. We can certainly sort of lower the tone of the rhetoric. I think things like, federal preemption laws that sort of stake out the territory so there aren't these sort of issues are a good idea. I'm skeptical of commissions, but hopeful. So I think that there is sort of a way to be collaborative, to be creative, and to kind of take one step at a time here.
I want to make sure we have time for audience questions. Sir.
I'm Joel Mulhauser. I have no personal involvement in any of this and no knowledge. I'm just the average American citizen. First of all, I think you made a very good point, and I may have missed this in the media, but I don't remember anywhere people talking about all these other cases. It sounded to me like it was one case, and maybe Apple could just do it one time, and that was the end of it. But clearly, it's nowhere near that. And again, I didn't know that, and maybe the rest of the public is smarter than I am, and they knew that, but I missed it. But my question is, I'm not sure I understood what you all said, because I'm not an expert in this. If there were 60 cases in New York where Apple or someone agreed to let them have the information, why have they denied it on the 61st? I mean, if they've agreed 60 times before, what about this? That case is different, or do they just change their mind, or is it a different legal issue? I'm not clear about that.
So the San Bernardino case is different.
No, I was referring to the first case, the Brooklyn case.
Right. So there are two sort of questions in the Eastern District case. The first is whether or not this is an appropriate use of the All Writs Act. And so a judge has determined that it's not. That will go up on appeal. And so this is something that Apple... basically hadn't thought of the notion before, right? They'd assumed the All Writs applied. They took a sort of, at the request of a judge, they took a hard look at the law and said, on second thought, maybe we can't be compelled to do this. So that's within their rights, and that'll go through the court. They have an alternative argument, and the alternative argument that they're saying on the record in the Eastern District of New York is that under the burden analysis, so this is that no one can be compelled to do that, which is overly burdensome, I think is the language. They are saying that it would be a reputational harm, that if Apple were to comply with the court order in that case, they would suffer economic damage to their reputation in the long term. That implicates some core understandings about civic duty, multinational, American corporations that have multinational markets. It's a very complex issue, but there's no security sort of concern there. They are saying it's a financial and reputational issue.
So essentially, Apple has changed its mind at this point, as opposed to the first 60 times.
I think it's fair to say that they've changed their mind, but I don't think it should be characterized necessarily as Apple is bad. Right, I think that they have changed their understanding of the operation of the law, but not based on the technology changes.
Hi, Jane Harmon again. I thought this panel was great, or I think this panel is great. And one of the reasons I think it is great is that it's a discussion in public about a set of complex issues. And so my question is this. When we, after 9/11, when all of us thought we might be attacked again, the Bush administration, Bush 43, term one, took most of its actions to thwart the threat by executive order. It turned out that memos were written in the Justice Department at the Office of Legal Counsel justifying a lot of this, and Congress was cut out. My question, and Congress caught up, and in the second term of Bush, there were a lot of actions in Congress. My question is this, how important is the public debate? At this point, when there are such complex issues, should the public be brought in and help determine the set of answers that our country will give to technology and to the need, I think everyone would agree with this, the need, if possible, consistent with our Constitution, to find out what bad guys are plotting before they hurt us?
I think public debate is critical, and thank you again, Congressman Harmon, for having this event. I really enjoyed it, and I learned a lot myself. Because the issues here are so monumental, right? They deal with privacy, with national security, with law enforcement, right? I mean, we all want crimes to be solved and people not to be injured or harmed. And so these are really large issues, and the public needs a way in because it's going to affect the public for years and years to come. How Congress acts, if Congress acts, or if the courts act, and how they act. So I think the public needs a way in. Don't know what the public's going to say. I think looking at the polls, depending on how you ask the question, you're going to get a different answer. And I think the public itself is somewhat conflicted on this issue because these are very complicated issues, and they do often raise conflicts that are not easy to solve.
I would just add that, you know, whenever you're having a public debate that's highly technical, that's always hard to have in a sophisticated, sort of informed way. And so I certainly hope that the technology community can also sort of take some leadership on really making sure that people understand the technical issues at play. I also think, though, it's important to not dismiss people who disagree with sort of the technical mindset. I think there is a little bit of a temptation to say, well, if you have sort of a different value or you come down a little differently, it's because you don't get it. If you knew math like we did, right? You just don't understand. I think it's just important, not that that it's indicative of the right or wrong answer, but it's important to sort of understand that it's possible for people to have sort of different values here, and to make sure we're being kind of respectful about all those values in the conversation.
So I just want to second all of that, but also point out that without a public debate, where we end up with is the national security bureaucracy makes the decision. They do it in secret. And it turns out, and I think the Snowden disclosures and where we are today illustrate that that's not only bad for human rights, civil liberties, and democratic government, it's bad for the intelligence community, because the Apple's resistance and the technology company's resistance to government access and insistence on the importance of encryption is, I believe, in large part a measure of the American public coming to understand that its intelligence agencies were accessing so much more of Americans' communications than we had any idea. And so we're still seeing the results of that. And so what I would say is that in this debate, when the law enforcement says, well, we want access when we have a warrant, That's one question. But we need to have in the debate, what about when you don't have a warrant, but you have some other authority that's going to allow you at the moment to get access in secret? Are you still asking then for encryption to be broken and that we have complete and candid answers to those questions from the national security side?
Yes, I'm Xiao Yan with the Voice of America. Can you address the international implication issues if governments like China ask Apple to do the same thing? Would Apple do it?
So this is actually a really complex question. I think there is a little bit of a tendency to say, well, Apple's going to be able to create the technical conditions, and therefore that's going to allow them to say no to other countries. It's not, nobody except for Apple and the Chinese government know what Apple's relationship with China is like. What Bruce Sewell, who is the Apple General Counsel, did testify yesterday, that Apple has complied with Chinese data localization laws. So that means that all data is stored within Chinese servers. It's commonly understood that the Chinese government maintains access to all data within China. Google, for example, rather than complying with data localization laws, elected to withdraw from that market. So while it's sort of it's difficult to know, it's not apples and oranges, right? Because the sort of the relationship to the data in question is very different. That said, certainly China is looking to what the United States is saying. Certainly this operates, this alters U.S. companies' abilities to negotiate with Chinese government, as sort of they tend to promulgate regulations that leave a lot of discretion. So it's very important, and at the same time, not quite as dispositive, I think, as sometimes people believe it can be.
I went to China last year in a congressional delegation, and one of the issues we raised was allowing more access for American businesses to the Chinese market, because they banned Facebook, they banned much of Google, because these U.S. companies would not agree to some of the very intrusive demands of the Chinese government. Our embassy continues to make arguments to the Chinese government saying, please allow more access to our U.S. businesses. It does somewhat undercut our ability to do that if here in the U.S. we then have our own government, right, going in, taking backdoors or backdoor ways to try to access smartphones. So I think this does have an effect how this issue is decided, not just in the U.S., but also how our businesses compete worldwide.
And the other international aspect, of course, is that encryption is it's critically important for dissenters, human rights activists around the world who live in repressive regimes. And sometimes it's a matter of life and death that they have access to encrypted communications.
The gentleman right there.
Howdy, my name is David. I'm working here at the Wilson Center. I'm an intern. This is sort of a tangential issue to the San Bernardino case and the other cases. How does this discussion change when you're talking about open source encryption? Because I know Apple, they write the program for the encryption, and they have a certain ability to break into it when they want to or when they're demanded to by the government. But with open source encryption, which I understand there's been some hostility towards it in general from some people in the intelligence community, can you speak to that?
If I understand your question correctly, right now two people can go on the internet, encrypt their communications, and the FBI cannot access it. And that sort of leads to a broader point where if you look at what the FBI and Department of Justice say is they say, look, there's all these dark spaces now that we can't access. My view of that is, well, in America, it's intentional we have a lot of dark spaces, right? Your bedroom is a dark space where we don't have the FBI listening in there. Your home is a dark space. In the San Bernardino case, it's probably likely that those two terrorists planned a lot of this just by talking to each other in their home, right? Dark spaces. And with encryption right now, you don't even need a smartphone. You can just encrypt with another person. FBI can't access it. And that does, right, at some level, maybe it's going to make it easier for some criminals and terrorists to take certain actions. But also, it does a lot to protect not just people's privacies, but companies' privacies. And strong encryption, again, is good for U.S. business, U.S. consumers, and U.S. national security.
Let's make sure to get somebody from the back in the blue tie.
Thank you. Nils Bildt, Modus. Two questions. One that hasn't really been addressed is, if you look at San Bernardino and the attack, is it really an existential threat? I would argue that it's not. We have 14 dead people, which is horrible, but it's not an existential threat to the existence of the country. So discussing this big an issue in the context of that one case might be the FBI taking things far out of proportion. And secondly, we've only touched on Apple, but let's say Apple were compelled to do this. Well, run off to blackphone.ch, and you're going to get something that's a lot harder to crack than an iPhone. So we're just moving the goalpost. There's just no end in sight.
So I think two things. One, certainly it's not an existential threat, and we shouldn't be making decisions, policy decisions, out of places of fear or terror, right? That said, we all sort of have collective understandings about what our expectations of law enforcement are like, their ability to investigate, prosecute, and prevent crimes. We're allowed to change our minds. That's right, this is sort of the beauty of the system. We get to pick kind of where we want all of these things to fall. And in terms of sort of the notion of moving the goalpost, sure, right, there's always going to be a more secure phone. There's always going to be third-party apps. There's always going to be the ability for two smart, committed bad guys to speak in a way that the government can't access. The question here is how big that space should be and sort of how manageable sort of the problem is. So I think that it's important to understand that there's no such thing as absolutes on either side. We're never going to get absolute cybersecurity. We're never going to get absolute physical security. It's a balance of how we want these all to fall.
I largely agree with that, but I think something to consider is it's easy to sort of point out, hey, a bad thing happened. But I think it's important to understand that lots of bad things happen when you don't have strong encryption. So we've been repeatedly harmed in the United States from weak encryption and weak cybersecurity defenses, right? Millions of security clearance records stolen. We've had businesses, Anthem Blue Cross, Target, Home Depot, hacked. We have suffered huge amounts of economic damages, national security risks. American lives are now at risk because of that hack at OPM last year. So I think it's important to sort of put on the scale, right, that weak encryption or pretty invulnerabilities to encryption has caused harm, will continue to cause harm. And that's just something people need to think about as they think about these issues.
Hi, Meg King with the Wilson Center. Thanks so much for doing this. And before my question, shameless plug for the Wilson Center Cybersecurity Lab. One of the reasons that we do that for Hill staff is to make sure that everyone has access to the technological information, how technology works, how smartphones work, what a networks mean, who are the bad actors, so that members of the congressional offices can have the best information possible. So my question is really about unintended consequences. Let's say a decision goes forward in one of these cases, like the San Bernardino case, and somehow Apple agrees to or is compelled to write new software, or this happens in some other case. We've seen incidents where that kind of a situation can actually, it's out in the open internet. Somebody will find it. There's a mistake somewhere because humans are still writing code. So how do we need to think about from the legal perspective, the privacy perspective, and how is U.S. Congress thinking about that issue?
So I think it's really important to sort of be honest about the various risks on all sides. And so the government would be very foolish to dismiss Apple's, I think, very sincere and genuine concerns. So one of the concerns is that Apple will not be able to maintain this software securely, that it will inevitably get stolen, or they'll have to use it so many times that it's going to compromise their ability to secure their keys. It's really important to sort of take those head on and decide kind of what the actual risk is. whenever I sort of think, I think it's really important to take the facts as they come, right? It's easy to kind of spin up into this, you know, backdoors into encryption, and right, like when there's really complex technical issues, I think it's important to take the technology as it is before the court, as it is sort of before the case and issue. You know, look, I'm sure that there are a great many number of technologists that will disagree, maybe even the congressman himself. You know, whenever I think about sort of the risk scenario here, I think, okay, sure, if the software is stolen, Apple has an impressive history of being able to secure things up until this point. They had essentially identical software, technologically different, but you know, software is software. They were able to secure it for many, many years. Okay, maybe this is different, and now this software will be stolen. Okay, who has the capacity to steal it? Who has the capacity to use it or repurpose it if they were to steal it? Okay, like so that's not just nation state actors, but it's like probably more than your ordinary thug. So we probably don't need to worry about people just grabbing iPhones out of one another's hands. All right, so I sort of, all right, that's what that group looks like. Okay, so then whenever you have this code, you actually need the device in question. So from sort of an intelligence perspective, I think, well, it's always better to get to find an intelligence vector where the person doesn't know, so they keep producing intelligence. So like stealing someone's iPhone is low on the list. You know, and I think I sort of think through, all right, so who would want to do it? How hard would it be? How would you secure the phone? And I kind of come down to, well, like a sloppy intelligence officer, that would be a real problem. Corporate espionage would be a problem. Potentially some border issues, things like that. I think that those are all real threats. We have to really think about it, but we also need to push the technologists and the tech companies past the initial representation of this is not safe, because they're right in a theoretical sense. If you create this code, something existed before something exists now that didn't exist before. But I think it's really important for even those of us who are not technologists to not be afraid of looking stupid, to saying, okay, but then what does that mean? What would happen next? So that we can get to the end and make a decision really based off of kind of the facts on the ground, instead of sort of just being afraid of ever sort of messing with anything, or taking sort of the first representations of a corporation that of course has you know, corporate obligations that are about maximizing value to shareholders and not sort of about protecting our civil liberties.
So in addition to being a recovering computer science major, I'm also a recovering lawyer. And so I want to talk about some of the legal risks. Because I think this should be settled by the American people with stakeholders in Congress, I do think the FBI should withdraw their case against Apple. I don't think they're going to do that. And if they don't, what will happen is this case will keep on being appealed. And one of the legal issues will be, can the government compel a private individual company to write software they do not have, to create something they don't? And let's say that gets a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, a huge region, and they decide that and say, yes, government can do that. Then you've got a principle here that you wonder, how will it be applied in the future? What else can government force you to do in terms of creating new things you don't have? And so there are legal risks to what's going on here. And so I think it's something we just need to think about as these cases move through the courts.
Right, and just to note, certainly the precedent here is important. Anyone who says, like, it's really just this one phone, I mean, it is kind of just this one phone, but there's certainly precedent here. I always caution against the slippery slope, which is a logical fallacy, if you know, from your early days of law school. And that's sort of this notion of courts apply the law as it is. You know, they're supposed to sort of divine it from on high, but it's supposed to be an objective standard. And so a little bit the fear of, well, if the law is correctly applied in this case, it would also be correctly applied in another case, and therefore it's not correctly applied in this case. I think that speaks to a need to change the law, a need to have real clarification about what sort of the scoping is, and maybe not necessarily a need to misapply the law to the extent a court believes it's a proper application.
Does the panel have time for one last question? Because we're a little over.
Thank you, I appreciate it. Tim Radout, fellow at GMF, German Marshall Fund. And I read Jim Comey's piece in Lawfare, and I think partly because we have so many smartphones, we're all distracted, it's impossible to get anyone to pay attention to anything today. So I think on a personal level, I think even just this case, just the debate it's created is valuable for our society. But so one thing, and you know, I'm thinking at this from more of an international security perspective, And I'm trying to sort of, you know, for the sake of public debate and, you know, norms and laws, to try to conceptualize and think about the difference between, you know, because in a computer science sense, data flowing through networks is all the same. It's all data packets. But there's data that can become information for the purposes of situational awareness, coordinating activity, and, you know, basically for human consumption. But then there's data that has kinetic effects that destroys critical infrastructure. So what role does encryption play in protecting those systems? Because to me, that's, you know, one of the biggest concerns, our electric grid, you know, all these things that it's not the information we care about, because it's not really, it's more machine-to-machine communication. Is this a useful way to think about it? And what role does encryption play on that? Thanks.
Well, you know, the president just announced a major cybersecurity initiative that's aimed at making the grid much more secure, at increasing the number of technologists in the country, et cetera, et cetera. But as part of that, they recognize that encryption is a key part of securing the grid and the rest of it.
And I think it's important to note, yes, everybody, I probably can't say everybody, but I think most sort of responsible voices believe that strong encryption standards are absolutely critical to securing all kinds of critical infrastructure. I do think it's important to note that the California smart grid is not defended by the mechanisms at issue in the Apple case, right? So sort of it's really important to understand the difference between the kinds of encryptions they're talking there and its connection and in some cases lack of connection to what's being requested sort of in an instant case.
So I'm going to scare you. When I talk about driverless cars, I believe that it's going to happen sooner rather than later. And the full vision of driverless cars is you got a bunch of these cars on the highway that are driverless. Last year, a car got hacked remotely. They took control of a Jeep and controlled it. So imagine if you don't have strong encryption and strong cybersecurity, a hacker taking control of a car on a highway and then slamming on the brakes when you're going 50 miles per hour. Not good. Or if a hacker took control of a car and ran it into a school. Or what if a hacker, because of weak encryption, installed a virus that said, you know, on January 1st, 2025, all cars that had this virus are going to accelerate to 100 miles per hour, right? So these are just very scary things I want you to think about, and that has to do if you don't have strong cybersecurity, strong encryption, and these are important issues to consider.
So on that note, I often say that politicians are analog and the problems are digital. And I think that is true. One politician is digital, and maybe he can educate us, others. The Wilson Center is educating congressional staff, including Andrew Lackman, who works for Ted Lieu, who is now going to be as smart as Ted Lieu, we hope. But the point is that without a public discussion of these issues, I think we are all lost. And wouldn't it be nice to have that public discussion take place in a congressional hearing room? Or think bigger, or maybe it is smaller in this year, wouldn't it be nice to have that discussion take place in a presidential debate? Maybe in the fall, a general election presidential debate.
Cybersecurity is going to be huge. It's huge.
All right. And certainly Politico is now better informed about this. I want to thank a very educated audience for tuning in, but I also want to make one last shameless self-promotion plug, and that is that places like the Wilson Center are going to have this conversation, and we are hopeful that that conversation will ripple out and will be held in more important fora in the White House, in the Congress, in the debates, so that the public can see who is better qualified to be president. And we have to have those debates now because, as Ted says, something bad could happen any time, and something bad could happen tomorrow. And if we don't have that debate, if we really believe, and I do, that security and liberty are not a zero-sum game, if we don't have that debate, we can repeat some of the mistakes, and they were not all mistakes, but some of the mistakes we made after 9/11 when we overreacted and did things in secret that we should have debated in public. So thank you all for coming, and thank this wonderful panel for spending an hour and a half.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced this week as every week in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the Wilson Center for audio of this event. Have you tweeted about the Lawfare Podcast yet or shared it with your friends on Facebook? Have you given us a rating on the iTunes store? People, friends, countrymen, you know what to do. Our music is performed, as ever, by the estimable, the Right Honorable Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.